Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We're also pleased to have here back with us once again, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is with us here every other month to do this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And the idea is, if you have basic kinds of questions about health, could be for yourself, could be for children in your family, because indeed Dr. Swearingen does see people of all ages in his practice, you can call in and discuss that with the doctor. And the only thing we try to remind people that, obviously, because the doctor cannot see you, cannot poke you, cannot take your vitals, there's a limit to what we can do on the program. But this is a place that you could start. You could ask him basic questions, and I know he would do his best, given the constraints of the show, to help you out. So all you have to do is give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here once again.
My pleasure, David.
Because we're here in a college town, every once in a while, here in our local media, we get stories about meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
And there is now a vaccine for meningitis.
Actually, there has been a vaccine for some time.
So, well, what's the the question I'm going for is this. Even though we know that occasionally there are outbreaks, particularly in college campuses where people are living very close together.
Right.
And we now have vaccine. While it's not required, I don't think colleges are saying you must.
Not in the state of Illinois.
But I'm thinking now, are physicians, are you at the point where you're recommending that if someone's child is going off to college for the first time this fall, that would you say, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, thinks that it would be a good idea if your kid gets the shot?
The answer is yes, and that advice has been been given out for the last several years. What is perhaps new is the fact that a variation of the meningitis vaccine has recently become available that, when present in large quantities, is going to be recommended for high school students as well.
Okay.
But the recommendation for entering freshmen in college who will be in a dorm setting has been on the books, so to speak, for a number of years. It also applies to military recruits because of the barracks-like, dormitory kind of setting that they live in during their training. So meningitis is an infectious disease that is more easily spread in situations where there's a lot of crowding, physical crowding. And so the college dorm and the military barrack setting are the two most common places where we can identify individuals who might be at higher risk. Fortunately, meningitis is a relatively rare illness, but it can be devastating when it does occur. It has a very high mortality rate, and it also has a very high morbidity rate in terms of complications related to the illness. Even when identified quickly and treated very appropriately, it's just a really nasty illness.
Yeah, we had in our newspaper here a very dramatic story about a young woman who was a student here who got the disease, and probably was lucky that she survived. She also lost both hands and maybe one of her
foot.
Feet,
mm-hmm.
And really, has the greatest, most positive attitude because she's going to live the rest of her life, and it doesn't matter that she doesn't have those things. She seems to be doing pretty well. But that's the kind of thing that if you could, you'd like to keep that from happening.
You'd certainly like to avoid it.
First place.
That's right.
So there are some states where if you're going there to university, they actually require you
yes.
have the vaccination?
Yes. Either individual academic institutions or the state may indeed require immunizations. As is true in most states, there's a listing of what immunizations kids are supposed to have before they go to kindergarten or first grade, and then they're supposed to be updated periodically over the course of their school years. But there wasn't any real consistent requirement for the meningitis vaccination, though the medical recommendations for it have been around for several years.
How long is the immunity good for once you get the shot?
That I don't think I know the specific answer to. I believe it's only recommended to be given once. So the assumption is either that it's going to be either lifelong or you're going to be no longer in a situation where you're at high risk.
So it ought to be one time, ought to at least be good for 4 years of college.
Correct.
All right. We have some callers here, and we'll get right to them. Someone in Champaign on a cell phone, they'll go first here. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
That time of year, and so I'd like to talk about the sun and the skin. I'm curious, I've heard the different stuff about, you know, irregular edges and things like that for things you should get checked out. I'm just curious what kinds of things in specific that you should go to the doctor and get checked out. And then also, when I go to the pool, I usually wear SPF 4, and I've just been told that that's terrible. I should be wearing something way stronger than that, even
30?
Though I never burn.
50? 15 would probably be a minimum.
Okay.
4 is probably not going to do much in the way of actual protection against sun damage, at least cumulatively. It may briefly delay your sunburn, but otherwise, yeah. If you're going to go to all the trouble of putting something on, I would put on a minimum of 15, and most folks are recommending 30 and above.
Okay.
In terms
I thought it was
of,
just to keep the burn away. I wasn't sure, you know.
Well, actually, the most common skin cancers are what are called basal cells and squamous cell cancers, are related to the cumulative amount of sun exposure you have over your life. So it does make a difference, even if you're not burning, as to how much sun exposure you're actually getting. Now, most of these common skin cancers are not fatal. They don't spread internally, but they can get locally larger. So you do want to try and take care of them sooner rather than later, simply so that you don't have to take a big chunk of your hide out to make it go away.
Right.
But ideally, you'd like to prevent it in the first place. The lesions that you want to pay attention to is anything that's new and growing. You mentioned it may be asymmetric. The most common typical of benign moles that people think of are usually oval or round and usually uniformly brown. And,
right.
And those are the typical things that we generally tell people not to worry about. But if something is becoming larger, and by larger we mean bigger than the head of an eraser.
Yeah.
Okay. If it's irregular, if it looks more like the map of the United States than it does an oval or a circle, then that's concerning. If it's not uniformly pigmented, you know, if it's black at one end and blue at the other and brown in between, that's not normal. Okay. And anything that draws attention to itself, if it itches, if it bleeds, if it scabs but never heals over, those are the sorts of things that you would want to have your physician take a look at and decide whether or not it needs to be biopsied.
And you can go to your general practitioner and they can take care of it there. You don't have to go to a dermatologist specifically for
that. That's correct.
Okay.
Because the procedure to simply biopsy a skin lesion in the office is a very minor one that takes just a couple of minutes. And even most small moles that need to be removed can still be removed in the office setting.
And so something that's just like mine is just a little larger than a pencil eraser now. They could still remove that there at the general practitioner's office?
Yes.
Ah, fabulous. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line two. This caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of weeks ago, maybe it's been almost 3 weeks, I went swimming in one of those natural pools, spring-fed kind of a pool, and I wore my contacts. Next morning, I woke up with a really red eye and stuff coming out of it. And I had always heard that when you have a virus, if it's a virus in your eyes, then it kind of cleans up on its own. And there's really not a lot you can do to treat it. So I didn't go see my doctor. Well, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm still having issues, and the other eye has kind of started to have issues. Is this about the time I need to go and have them looked at?
Certainly anything that's persisted this length of time should be evaluated. And the other part of this that might be contributing to it, if you're continuing to wear your contacts, you may not be...
I haven't been able to. I've put them in a couple of times, and it's just been, you know, really bad the next morning, next day. So I've just stopped even trying.
Right. And that's probably a good thing to do. What's referred to as conjunctivitis, many people have referred to as pink eye. And there are basically three different kinds. There's a bacterial infection, and that's what people refer to as pink eye, and that is fairly contagious, and that's what typically makes the rounds in daycares and nursery schools and, church Sunday school classes, because kids will rub one eye and then go play with another kid, and they'll end up sticking it in their eye. There are viral conjunctivitises, which are typically referred to as that cold in your eye, and you usually have other cold symptoms along with it. And then some people have allergic conjunctivitis as well, related to seasonal allergies. Now, in your particular case, whether the pool had anything to do with it or not, it's kind of hard to tell. But this is a situation where if your symptoms really haven't resolved, it's time to go have it looked at.
Okay, now if it is viral, what can they do?
A viral conjunctivitis should have run its course in no more than a week.
Oh, really?
Right.
Okay. Well, I don't have any of those other cold symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And the allergies, well, you know, they're kind of always there, but fairly under control otherwise. And so it could be something different then, or what other things could cause that kind of red eye irritation? I don't think it's bacterial because, neither my husband nor my kid has gotten it either, and no mm-hmm. one else around me has gotten it. So,
well, there's several other less common medical conditions. Iritis will present with a red eye, but it's usually a painful eye. And people who have acute angle closure glaucoma will also have a painful red eye. So there are several other medical conditions that are at least need to be thought about if your symptoms are persisting.
Well, can I just see my family doctor, or do I have to go to an ophthalmologist?
Well, you could probably start with your family doctor because the basics in terms of your eye exam can be done there. If there's concern that there's something going on the inside of the eye, the iritis or glaucoma type problems, then you'll need to see your eye doctor. But those are relatively uncommon, and I would probably have you start with your family doctor first.
Okay. But generally, if there's red, itchy stuff coming out, it's probably some kind of conjunctivitis.
Correct.
Okay, great. All right, thanks for your help.
All right, thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have some general kinds of health care questions, I know he will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's another caller from Marshall, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes, my mother-in-law, her right arm the other day turned really dark blue, and so she held it above her head for a while, and the color went away, and then it kind of came back when she's normally. Is this something serious, something that can be treated, or you have an idea of what's up?
Was there any pain or discomfort associated with the fact that it looked blue to you?
No. We didn't see it. She was telling my wife and I about it.
Oh. A positional change in color of the extremity would tend to imply a shift in the venous blood either into or out of the arm. If the arm is down and is looking darker blue but then looks better when elevated, it implies that blood is being sort of dependently layered into the arm as a result of gravity and essentially poor venous return out of the arm back to the body. By itself, that's not a common occurrence. The other symptoms that would need to be checked for would be any type of pain or weakness in the arm or any persistent swelling in the arm that might suggest some type of blockage or clot in the veins. Blood clots in veins are much more common in the legs as compared to the arms.
Yeah.
But they can occur in the arms in some situations. So if this is something that she notices persistently, then yeah, this is something that needs to be checked out, and I would be much more concerned about her circulation than anything else.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back to sun exposure for a second, having now had frequent chats here on this program over the years with several dermatologists, I know that what they would recommend, what they seem to be recommending now, is that almost whenever we go out of the house, we should be wearing sunscreen on the parts of our body that are commonly exposed, you know, hands, arms, face, neck. And also they would say you also should think about the fact that the damaging sun rays can go through your clothes, so that if you're, say, you know, you're going to go outside and work in the yard and you got a T-shirt on, what do? Well, you put your sunscreen on your arms, put it on your neck, put it on your face. You don't do anything for that part that's covered because you think, well, that's covered. But in fact, I think a T-shirt has an SPF of about, I don't know, 3 or 4, right, something like that. So the rays are still going through. So they probably would like us to be slathered up, you know, almost head to toe every day.
Or they actually sell clothing that has built-in UV protection, which is primarily, you know, marketed to people who, like you say, might be out gardening, or the outdoor enthusiast who's spending a lot more time outdoors than, say, the average office worker.
Yeah. So that might be something. And actually, I think also they sell something that you can put in with your clothes when you wash them that does that same kind of thing. So that's what the dermatologists tell us. We're not doing that, of course. What's your thought about this? About how much, you know, what do you do, for example?
Well, there is no doubt that you know, cumulative sun exposure is directly related to the skin cancers that we mentioned before, because most basal cell and squamous cell cancers are relatively small, non-invasive. People generally don't die from them. There's probably not as much attention paid to that as the dermatologist might like. The one type of skin cancer, which is malignant melanoma, that everybody should pay attention to, can indeed be fatal. And these are typically the very black, midnight blue, sometimes very irregular in appearance in terms of their coloration, frequently grow, are noticeable. Those are the ones that need to be taken care of early. And those are the ones where, in terms of sun exposure, it's really thought that the burning that some kids get early in life sets them up for this. And that's why, if anybody's really going to be concerned, I would encourage parents to make sure that their kids get their sunscreen on, because the kids spend a whole lot more time outdoors. And in fact, that's where the majority of most adult sun exposure has come during their life, is their childhood years. And that's the time to be perhaps most vigilant about using the sunscreen, which is really for the kids. Personally, you know, if I'm going out, I have SPF 15. Lotion that I put on my hands and face and neck, and I am not lathering up my entire body. And the other part that's commonly recommended is to try and avoid the peak times of sun exposure where the rays are most damaging, and that's typically between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. And then the other thing to do is to try and physically block out as much of the sun exposure as you can. And that's where, you know, wearing a hat or being in the shade as opposed to working out in direct sun comes into play. All of these things done cumulatively over time will significantly reduce the amount of sun exposure you get and the amount of damage that you get. And for women who are interested in their looks, it will significantly decrease the amount of wrinkles that one gets. I recall a fairly memorable picture from a dermatology lecture that I had at a conference, and the presenter showed a picture of a Muslim woman who had always worn a veil. And he showed her picture without the veil and asked everybody to guess her age. And the average age guessed was 45. Turned out she was 72. And it was primarily because there wasn't much aging in terms of the wrinkles that came from sun exposure. And it was really pretty dramatic.
Well, other questions here, welcome. We had somebody ready to go. And if you'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone on our toll-free line in Shumway. Hello.
Hello. I had a couple questions I'd like to ask the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about this blood clot and varicose veins. Do you, like, if you had your leg, say, example, would you have to have an MIR or would an X-ray be sufficient to find out what you had?
If you're concerned about a blood clot in the vein of the leg, the best test is a sonogram called a venous duplex. And this allows us to evaluate how well blood is flowing through the vein. A plain X-ray will not show you anything in great detail other than the bony structures of the leg, and so isn't particularly useful when you're concerned about a clot. An MRI, if it's not done with contrast, something in the blood vessel itself, again, is not going to be terribly useful. So if you're really concerned about a clot in the veins of the leg, a venous duplex, which is a type of sonogram test, is the best test for that.
Well, thank you very much. On that line, if you had varicose veins, do they put plastic in there now, or when they strip those out, or what do they do to replace them veins?
Well, actually, they don't replace them. You mentioned stripping them, and that is just to mechanically remove the vein from underneath the surface of the skin, and that is still done with very large veins that can't be sclerosed. The other method that you're sort of alluding to is with smaller veins, you can sometimes inject a substance into them that causes them to scar down, and they'll no longer hold blood, so you won't be able to see them.
Okay. Now, what if it would, the problem would be an artery, then what do you do there?
If you have a blockage in an artery, especially to the leg, if it's a mild blockage, you may not be aware of it. If it's a moderate blockage, you will probably start to get symptoms when you walk, because when you walk, the muscles of the leg need more oxygen, and the blood is carrying oxygen to those muscles in your legs. And if they can't get enough blood in there, then those muscles start to hurt due to lack of oxygen. And this is frequently a symptom that we hear from patients. They describe that they're able to walk two or three blocks. They start to get pain in their legs, and they have to either slow down or stop. Once they rest and circulation resumes into a muscle at rest, then they feel better and they can walk two or three more blocks. But in a situation where an artery is suddenly blocked, then you've lost all circulation to that point past that point. And then in that particular setting, you have about 6 hours to save that leg. But that's going to be a very sudden, painful occurrence, and it's going to be something that you're going to have a hard time ignoring.
Okay. Now, in other words, it would probably start maybe in the foot and work up. Is that the way that...
The most common complaint in terms of walking pain related to poor circulation in the arterial side of the circulation is usually in the calf. That's the most common place because that's where the larger muscle for walking is in the calf.
Would it be any swelling, say, an ankle part?
You can get swelling just due to varicose veins because, again, blood isn't being pumped back out of the leg like it should be. Generally speaking, swelling is usually related to a blockage either in the venous part of the circulation or sometimes in the lymphatics, the other channels that carry fluid.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go to next someone in Rantoul, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to the skin problem. I spent some time in the dermatology department last week because I'm now in my 80s, but when I was very young, I was red hair. I had a red hair and fair complexion. But we were told to get out in the sun. Get out in the sun. You know, it's good for you. So as a result, through the grace of God, I don't have many wrinkles. But I couldn't keep track of the number of skin cancers that I have had removed already. And I am also a good example or a bad example to my children because they were being a little lax about using that. And they've seen what I went through last Thursday. I had a biopsy done on my forehead. And the shots that I got just to so that it wouldn't be so painful were the most painful things that I've had done to me in a long time. So I want to say that, or warn people, that this isn't just hype. It's serious. As I said, I can't keep track of the number that I have had of skin cancers that I have had removed already. Mm-hmm. And to use that the best skin blocker that you can get. So that's my testimony.
Thanks for the testimonial. I think it's certainly good advice, particularly if you're fair-skinned, but I'm sure the dermatologist would say it does not matter.
It does not matter.
It does not matter. You should still be, everybody should be doing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. She points out a kind of an interesting piece of advice that was indeed given years ago. A certain amount of vitamin D is indeed necessary for our bodies to function well. In particular, most women are aware that they need vitamin D for calcium metabolism, which is one of the things that helps prevent osteoporosis. The sun is actually an excellent source of vitamin D because when our skin is exposed to sunlight, we produce vitamin D. And back in the days before foods were fortified with vitamins, in particular milk, mm-hmm. now typically has vitamin D in it. Mm-hmm. But many, many years ago when there weren't vitamins and foods hadn't been fortified with other things, a certain amount of sun exposure was indeed probably a healthy thing to do, but not really an excuse anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go talk with someone in Toledo, Illinois, line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
For some time, I've had a spot, sort of like a rash on the side of my nose, and it is very itchy at times. And I can picture the sun coming through the side of the driver's side of the car window. And is a skin cancer ever itchy?
Yes. But generally, it's not something that would necessarily be described as a rash. In most instances, there's either going to be something raised or something that has some texture to it when felt.
Just slightly rough.
That slightly rough feeling is very commonly associated with what's called an actinic keratosis. And this is sun-damaged skin that hasn't quite yet become a skin cancer. Now, the only way to really know that for sure is to have your physician take a look at it, sometimes biopsy it to be sure. But sun-damaged skin can be treated very commonly in the office setting with just a little liquid nitrogen to freeze that superficial layer of skin that's abnormal, make it die and slough off, and then replace it with new skin.
I see. Okay.
But that roughened area, if it doesn't go away, if it's persistent, should indeed be looked at. When we think about the progression from normal to cancerous, there is always sort of an in-between state. And what's referred to as an actinic keratosis is often that in-between state.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you take allergy or food sensitivity questions?
We're happy to take any question. We can't promise to answer all of them.
Well, I had it happen twice last summer, about 6 months apart. I ate at two different restaurants. The first one I had, well, it was an ordinary meal, say beef tips over noodles and potato, mashed potatoes, and et cetera. Within 15 minutes, I began to feel like I was nauseated. But the palms of my hands, the soles of my feet began to itch like crazy. I broke out in a sweat from head to toe. And I had a little diarrhea, but that didn't bother me like the other feeling. The symptoms were exactly alike. The second meal I had was at a Chinese restaurant where I had all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm figuring it may be a preservative in the beef. That's the only thing I can think of, really. No seafood. Well, the second place I had seafood, but not the first one.
It is indeed possible, and other than sort of a trial and elimination attempt at trying to sort out what you've come in contact with and what you tolerate and what you don't, there really isn't any other good test for most food-related allergies.
Well, the first place would have been simple, you know, very simple meal, but, mm-hmm. you know, at a Chinese buffet.
Could have been anything, right?
A lot of different things.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. The question is, again, welcome. We'll continue to talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is a family practice doctor, and every other month he's here for the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. General questions are welcome, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer or at least help you out a little bit. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about another vaccine issue in the news. There has now, the FDA has approved a vaccine for the human papilloma virus, which is something that is causes, among other things, causes genital warts, but it is also thought that some of them, and there, apparently there are a lot of different ones, some of them may indeed be the cause of genital cancer, cervical cancer in women. And so we now have a virus that is thought to be protective against the forms of the virus that are – we have vaccine for the forms of the virus that are implicated most. And it's been approved for girls and women, not yet been approved for men. Because the virus is sexually transmitted, you're going to want to give the vaccine to people before they become sexually active, if it's going to do what you want it to do. Is there some what's the conversation like, or is there some conversation going on about when you're going to give the shot, and are you going to make some kind of recommendation that says all girls at the age of 12, you know, something like that? And then maybe eventually, if it's tested and approved on men, so maybe then we'll say everybody at, I don't know, who knows, 10, 12, 14, somebody's gonna sit down and make a rule, and everybody's going to get it. Is there some conversation like that going on?
There are multiple conversations like that going on, and no clear consensus yet as to who and when. The thing that drives a lot of the vaccine recommendations for the public at large turn out to be what schools require. In many instances, the public schools say you have to have X and Y and Z or we won't let you in school. Mm-hmm. And then it pretty much becomes, okay, well, everybody has to have X and Y and Z before they can go to school. And we frequently end up with a new vaccine. There will be, at some point, a medical recommendation as to who and when should receive this vaccine. And then if it turns out to be, one, efficacious and well-tolerated and thought to be in the sort of general public interest, in many instances, the state departments of health will recommend to the school systems, this should be a required immunization. Since this is not an illness that's likely to be contracted during school, though I don't know how much time alone you get in study hall anymore. Whether it'll become a school-related issue or not, I don't really know at this point. In all likelihood, it will simply be something that will be discussed with a patient and their parents at a regular well-child exam at a particular age and say, this is what we know, and to sort of summarize, it's felt that a fair number of cervical cancers are caused by particular types of human papilloma virus exposure. Mm-hmm. There, as you pointed out, there are multiple different varieties of HPV, only some of which seem to be associated with cancer. In the majority of cases, if you're exposed to the other forms of HPV, it eventually goes away by itself, causing no particular problems. So the vaccine basically targets those particular strains that are thought to be associated with the development of cancer, with the idea of trying to immunize you against that, such that if you're exposed, you're not likely to have that virus then multiply in women in the cervix, which is where over a long period of time, the development of cervical cancer usually takes a very, very long time, as in years, to occur. And this will be my opportunity to remind women that a regular pap smear is the single most useful test for cervical cancer. And a pap smear should be able to detect at a very, very early, very, very easily treatable stage any abnormalities on the cervix. And so one of the most important things is just make sure that you're getting your pap smear done on a very regular basis. Now, as you mentioned, the human papillomavirus also causes genital warts. It is a sexually transmitted infection, and all women, regardless of what other method of contraception they're using, should be having their partners wear a condom, because that's the only way that you're going to actually prevent the transmission of sexually transmitted illnesses. And HPV is only one of many potentially sexually transmitted diseases.
So the bottom line is here, do you think that at least for the foreseeable future, this is going to be a discretion kind of thing? Physician, probably it's going to be ended up being pediatrician, I would guess.
Actually, most pediatricians don't do a whole heck of a lot with pap smears, sexual issues. Many pediatricians, by the time kids hit adolescence, are saying, you know, maybe you should go. Now, that's not true for all pediatricians, and there is actually becoming now a subset of pediatrics devoted just to adolescents. But this is an area where family physicians, because they do see people throughout the entire age spectrum, are very comfortable doing this, and obviously gynecologists are quite comfortable with this kind of discussion as well.
Okay. Well, we got some other callers here. Let's talk with them. Next in line is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether, in terms of the previous caller, that possibly MSG? She was talking about Chinese food.
Correct. In terms of Chinese food, and it's simply a question of whether it was present in the meal that she had eaten elsewhere.
But sometimes what happens, some of these restaurants will add it to enhance beef, non-Chinese restaurants. So it might be something she might want to take a look at.
Certainly on the list of things to check out. You're exactly right.
Okay, thanks for the thought. Let's go next to the next caller, and this would be someone over in Indiana on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Why, doctor, could you discuss hiatal hernias? What causes them? What are the signs and symptoms? Can they cause peripheral pain in the thorax? Is surgery a solution for them, and is it invasive, very invasive, and what is the percentage of success?
All righty. We'll give it our shot. By definition, a hiatal hernia is an opening in the diaphragm that allows part of the stomach to come up from the abdomen up into the thorax. All by itself, that in and of itself usually doesn't cause any significant symptoms. What does usually cause symptoms is what's referred to as gastroesophageal reflux. And this is when contents of the stomach come up through and into the esophagus. Generally, the esophagus is in your thorax. The diaphragm divides your esophagus from your stomach. Your esophagus is not designed to hold acid. Your stomach is. When acid from your stomach gets up into your esophagus, it results in what people refer to as heartburn or indigestion. Or when it's really bad, it'll cause irritation to the esophagus that can cause damage to the lining of the esophagus. Reflux of this nature and hiatal hernias can be seen at the same time, but they can also occur independently. So in many instances, before thinking about having any kind of surgical procedure to fix a hiatal hernia, what you want to try and do is identify, if I'm having any kind of symptoms, is it due to reflux disease? Because if you treat the reflux and your symptoms go away, in many, many instances, you don't have to do anything about the hernia. It doesn't generally hurt anything at all to have a little bit of your stomach protrude up out of the abdomen into the thoracic cavity. So if you're having any kind of symptoms, it's generally not due to the hernia, but oftentimes related to reflux of acid from the stomach up into the esophagus. So that's the place that I would probably have you start first if you're having any kind of symptoms before you would entertain the thought of surgery, because there really aren't too many times when you really have to fix a hiatal hernia. For some individuals who have bad reflux disease, there is a surgical procedure where they tighten the opening between the esophagus and the stomach to try and minimize acid getting back up into the esophagus. This is called a Nissen fundoplication. And during that procedure, they can also close any opening between the thoracic and abdominal cavities. But again, this is separate from the hernia, because the hernia itself is usually something that doesn't cause any symptoms.
Is it major surgery?
To fix it would be a fairly significant procedure, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what about success rate? Anything about that?
Oh, if all you're talking about is tucking everything back in place and, you know, making sure it stays there, that's usually a very successful surgery.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right, thank you. We'll go next to a caller in Paris, Illinois, on our line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In my 60s, I've had glasses since about 12. Farsighted. I want to see what some of the latest procedures are for being able to do without glasses, and then also how that affects, if any, the possibility of having cataracts on down the line. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. What's referred to commonly as laser vision correction surgery has become quite popular. And I am not aware of any information linking it to an increased risk of cataracts. Cataracts are basically thickenings or opacities that occur in the lens that are generally attributed to just aging, though trauma can also cause them to appear. So I wouldn't have any real qualms about cataract formation as a result of laser vision correction surgery. With the procedures that are available now, you can take somebody who's nearsighted and improve their distance vision. You can take somebody who has good distance vision and change the shape of their cornea and allow them to see up close. What is difficult to do because of the physical limitations of the aging eye, and by that we mean probably anybody over the age of 40, is it is very difficult in the same eye to allow both near and far vision pretty much simultaneously. In order to have near vision as you get older, you have to be able to what we call accommodate. There has to be some physical change in the in the eye that allows you to then focus up close. And people simply lose that as they get older. Now, you can fix their eye so that it focuses near, but it at this point, it's difficult to make it near and far at the same time. Now, what some people have chosen to do, either with surgery or contacts, is you can have one eye for distance, and you can have one eye for near vision, and some people get used to that and like it, and other people, it just drives them crazy, and they don't like it. But this is an area where the technology now is such that you can indeed change the shape of the cornea, and you can correct very, very many of the previously visual abnormalities that required glasses or really weren't even correctable.
Mm-hmm. I think it's still true that some people, though, you can get them so that they have pretty good general vision, but as you say, that you may still have to have something to help you to do close work like reading.
Right.
You may still have to wear... You may be able to drive okay, mm-hmm. to get around okay, but to read, you might have to have reading glasses.
Right. And for some people, that's adequate because you can go down to the pharmacy and buy a $5 pair of, my patients call them cheaters, which are just magnifying glasses that allow you to then see close up. And that's why you see people as they get older, you hand them something to read. Instead of pulling it closer to the face, they actually hold it farther away from themselves to read it. And that's just a natural aging phenomenon.
Yeah, that's what they, in the business, they call the arms too short syndrome.
Right.
You just can't quite figure out where you're going to get that thing. Let's talk with somebody in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, what do you think of the practice of taking vitamins that broad spectrum vitamin, or say someone in their late 60s?
Currently, some of the national medical societies have blanket recommendations that a good multiple one a day kind of vitamin is probably not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
It probably wouldn't be necessary if everybody ate the recommended foods that are promulgated, but in truth, hardly anybody does that. So a good multiple vitamin once a day is probably just a pretty safe, easy, cheap insurance plan to make sure that you're getting all the trace nutritional elements that you need. And there aren't any reported downsides to doing that. You don't need any extra iron. And so I wouldn't necessarily be recommending anything with a lot of extra iron in it, but just a good multiple vitamin is probably reasonable.
I was just wondering. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. If somebody wants to dial real quick here, we might be able to get him in. We have a couple minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm thinking here just because now we're in summertime and a lot of people are going to be doing outside work. A lot of people like to garden, like to dig in the dirt. Maybe just a tiny note about tetanus, which is this thing when we were growing up, it was, you got it by stepping on a rusty nail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with rusty nails. Tetanus apparently is a thing that's everywhere.
It's a microorganism that actually lives in the soil,
mm-hmm.
and so it's always there, and it can indeed cause problems if you get exposed and you're not immunized against it. I'm glad you mentioned this because they have just recently changed the vaccination for adults. Adults are supposed to get a tetanus booster every 10 years. They now recommend a booster for pertussis, which is whooping cough. And they have a combined vaccination for tetanus and pertussis for adults. And it's still that once every 10-year schedule. So we have recently begun changing our recommendations from everybody needs a tetanus booster to everybody needs a tetanus booster and a pertussis immunization every 10 years as an adult. But fortunately, it's still just one shot.
Mm-hmm. We'll I'm sorry. I don't think we really do have time for this last caller. My apologies, because I said you could call, and then now I'm saying that you can't because we're pretty much just at the end of the time. Following up on that last thought real quick, I was just thinking, would you say that for people who are going to be working outside, digging in the dirt, maybe it'd be a good idea, in addition to making sure that you have your tetanus booster updated, that you wear gloves?
Oh, yes.
Have something on your hands just
it's the direct them. Exposure of the soil into a break in the skin. That's going to be your source of contact, and that's why the rusty nail out in the yard was such a problem, because you stepped on it, went right through your shoe, and penetrated the soft tissues.
Okay. Any last little thing you'd like to leave with folks?
I'll leave it up to
wear
you.
Your sunscreen.
Wear your sunscreen and your hat.
And your hat. All right. Very good. Yeah. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you, David.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is here every other month to do the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So I guess we'll see you again in August.
I'll plan on it.
Very good.